full house. My request for testimony is that everyone speak like the reading clerk in the house at about that speed, and we'll slow the tape down and listen to it later. Okay, I want to welcome the treasurer. Agenda information. We will take House Joint Resolution 46 first, then to House Bill 3370. I'm told we have a very short hearing then on 2908, and then we will spend the devote the rest of the time to House Bill 3400. Hearing room C is available for overflow.
Okay.
Although it has to be vacated by 2:30, is that what I understand, for another committee, apparently? Okay, so I would encourage everybody, please, today to be succinct, and if you have heard another witness already testify in substance to what you had to say, you may just want to incorporate their testimony, and I would encourage you to do that. Okay, let's open then a public hearing on HJR 46, and welcome Mr. Treasurer and your entourage. Steve, do you want to give us the background on HJR 46? Interest of time, we'll just proceed with you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you briefly about House Joint Resolution 46, a bill to improve the state's finances and to give you a low-cost financing tool to meet the state's growing capital needs. As you know, the state is growing and changing, and as a result, we have ever-increasing capital and investment needs that must be met to meet the quality of life here. Needs such as upgrading and modernizing our schools, our parks, meeting a voter mandate like Measure 11, or making an investment like OHSU's Oregon Opportunity to invest in biomedical research. The state has a long history of utilizing bond financing to meet some of these capital needs. It is a prudent fiscal tool. Issuing bonds, I want to reiterate, is not issuing credit card debt. It saves money by locking the cheaper cost of money today and spreading the costs over the life of the project. That's why bonds are seen as a prudent form of investing in capital by both business and the public sector. The reason I'm here, along with others supporting this resolution, is because the state needs a new general obligation bond, as outlined in this resolution, to meet its growing capital needs. Let me just give you a couple examples of how we finance ourselves, and as for the sake of time, you've got my testimony, and hit some of the high points of the needs and how this tool could be utilized. Currently, we've issued, as many of you know, a number of lottery-backed bonds to finance a number of projects in the state. As you know, and I sent out a letter to many of the, to all the members talking about that the capacity to issue any more lottery-backed bonds are likely to be consumed this legislative session under the governor's proposal. I believe that in and of itself makes it even more compelling that we look for a new tool to help you make capital investments long-term in Oregon. We've also turned to certificates of participation to finance, for example, ballot Measure 11 to build new prisons around the state. This has limited use, and it has cost the state more to issue those types of financing. I also believe, and it's embedded in this resolution, that the state has a responsibility, in addition to meeting its general investments in a variety of capital needs of Oregon, to look at its responsibility towards helping schools meet their capital needs. Most states have a financing mechanism by which they can help school districts meet their capital needs. It's time that Oregon has that as well. Let me just briefly cover how the state issues bonds so that you understand my role in this process and your role. Briefly, the legislature controls the issuance of bonds by granting the authority to agencies to issue the bonds for a variety of purposes that you've helped outline with them in their budgets. As treasurer, I issue all the state bonds on behalf of the state agencies, working with those agencies and under the authority you have given them each biennium. I work with the investment banking community to help ensure that the state gets the lowest cost of interest rates when we go to market. I also want to say that I also, part of my mandate is to make sure that we have a strong credit rating, which saves us, state and taxpayers, millions of dollars over time by making sure we have the lowest interest when we sell bonds in the marketplace. My role is to help develop the most prudent method of financing to help the state and help have give you the opportunity to meet some of these capital needs and to maintain the state's good credit. That means that we should prudently use the lowest cost of capital for us. And the cheapest way for us to do that is to have a general obligation bond, which could be used for a variety of purposes. And again, that's spelled out in this resolution. Currently, the Oregon Constitution has been amended to provide GO bonds for very limited projects, such as higher education facilities, veterans home loan, energy loans, to name a few. The reason the GO bond authority is in the Constitution is because of a unique provision that prohibits the state from going into debt more than $50,000. The current authority supersedes that limitation. However, our need to finance other projects continue to grow and change as the state also needs the ability to meet that changes in the state. House Joint Resolution 46 will provide the authority to issue general obligation bonds for a variety of projects such as, again, as I mentioned, repairing and upgrading older public school buildings and building new schools in fast-growing districts. And now that nearly all K-12 operating funds come from the state, I believe it is our responsibility to help school districts meet their growing capital needs with matching grants. The bill will also grant the authority to issue general obligation bonds for other public purposes as you deem necessary, such as Oregon Health Sciences University biotech investment that is before this body this session. And I'd like to just highlight how this tool could save, just on that investment alone, millions of dollars. The state is being asked to finance that project for $200 million. Given two different ways in which we can finance it, one it would allow us to use general obligation bonds if we had the authority, and the other currently would be to use tobacco settlement monies. And then as part of the handout that for you shows the cost differential and the interest rate differences between using a general obligation bond, which is on the top line, and what we would use just using tobacco revenue bonds. And the difference is stark. It's a $70 million cost differential between the two. And that's just for this one project. So over time, we would obviously see hundreds of millions of dollars saved by having this new tool. The resolution has a unique feature in that these are not backed by a statewide property tax at all, as all other general obligation bonds are. The authority to issue a property tax is not necessary in order for us to get a good interest rate. In fact, many states don't have that credit feature. The state does have sufficient bonding capacity to support a general purpose general obligation bond program. According to the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, the state currently has excess bonding capacity in the range of $2.5 to $3 billion, not including the revenue from the tobacco settlement. And I'm not here to advocate that we go out and issue that many bonds immediately. What I am asking is that we have a tool and that you have a tool to meet a growing need in the state and to have a tool that's the lowest cost for Oregon. Again, many states have utilized this tool. We don't have it. It's time that Oregon does. And I'd be happy to answer any questions specifically you may have about the resolution. And I appreciate your patience this afternoon.
Questions for the treasurer? I guess we came having read the resolution as printed. Could you just highlight the differences between the resolution as printed and the dash three amendments that are before us this afternoon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me is Doug Goh from the law firm Ader Wynn, who could maybe just briefly touch on the high points of the difference between the draft and the amendment.
Go.
Thank you. The amendments really are technical in nature. We trying to address both the flexibility, as the treasurer indicated, to both K-12 schools and then any other public purpose that the legislature would deem appropriate. We focus to clarify that the ad valorem, that is, no property tax in power of the state would be pledged to repayment of the bonds. Only non ad valorem tax in power would be pledged. I think we tried to clarify that in Section 2, the potential sources of repayment of the bonds, and again, the legislature, we've tried to provide the legislature the flexibility to pay those from lottery monies, from the tobacco monies, taxes levied to pay the bonds other than property taxes, and really, to, again, to provide the legislature the flexibility over the time, given current circumstances, to determine at that point in time what would be the most appropriate repayment source.
Mr. Gill, let me ask, and again, I'm looking at this for the first time, but if we look at sub 2 of section 1, this is on line 17 of the dash 3s, is any indebtedness incurred under this section shall be, I'm looking at section 1, line 13, we authorize the issuance of indebtedness to provide funds to finance the cost of providing kindergarten to 12th grade public schools and for other public purposes determined by the Legislative Assembly. That doesn't, Edwards, I guess I'll ask, that doesn't address capital needs. Appears to be a general funding authorization for the cost of providing public schools. Did you intend to go beyond the capital?
No, and I think that that is addressed in the section 3 on page 2, lines 6 through 13 details really what the purpose is, and those are capital costs. In addition, I think the accompanying bill 3370 makes clear that the focus is on capital costs.
But I just want to be clear on what the constitutional amendment.
Absolutely.
Because you're referring to lines 6 through 13 of the dash 3s on page 2, but then
yes.
we do have that sentence on 13 through 15 that says, additionally, the proceeds are used to provide funds for any other public purpose. And again, tying that back in with the language on page 1, that would appear to go beyond capital for schools or capital for any other purpose to apparently anything the legislature deems a public purpose.
The chair is correct. As currently drafted, that would provide the flexibility, not with respect to K through 12 schools, but with respect to other purposes generally.
And not even limited to capital, at least the way it's drafted.
As drafted, it could be read to not be limited to capital.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bates.
As I read this, I have to agree with the chair. It also doesn't limit capital for schools either. It says to provide funds to finance the cost. Not the capital cost, the cost of providing kindergarten through grade 12 public schools.
Again, with respect to the proposed amendments, I would draw the attention to page 2, lines, sub 3, line 6, actually line 7, used to provide matching funds to finance the capital cost.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
As I read that line, it doesn't say the proceeds from bonds issued and only. It just says any bonds issued under this section may be used to provide matching funds. May be used to provide matching funds to finance the capital costs of kindergarten through K-12 schools. It doesn't say it may only.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing clearly says it can be used for anything. I mean, we need to clear some language up here. That's not your intent, obviously.
That is not the intent. The point is well taken, and we certainly can address the issues raised on those points.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think obviously we're making that for the record, but as well we could look at the language itself, and again for the other purposes. For the most part, again, we're looking at making capital financing finance here with this new tool. And there are limitations to what you can issue bonds for in the marketplace. We can't just issue them for anything which isn't bound by federal law and tax code that drives how we as a state can issue these bonds.
Right. Mr. Gill?
I would just offer to the committee, I think with respect to K through 12 schools, I think clearly the intent has been, even though we may not have reflected it here, to address capital costs. With respect to other purposes, I would suggest, and I'm not the policy makers and the treasurer addresses this, but just since this is a constitutional amendment, as bond counsel, when we have to interpret these things 20 years from now, 30 years from now, it's helpful to have some flexibility so that if the legislature decides that there's a de minimis amount because they want to do something like the Oregon Opportunity, and that may have costs that aren't strictly capital costs. It might include, for example, recruiting costs, scholarship costs, endowment costs, and the legislature makes the determination that those are an eligible public purpose to have that flexibility within the Constitution, I think would be helpful.
I just, comparing the language of the Nash Treaties with the original resolution, that the original resolution was very clear on line 13, referring to providing kindergarten through 12th grade public school facilities, and in sub 2, lines 14 to 18, also very specific as to public school facilities and then dealing with acquisition, construction, improvement, remodeling. And so I assume there was an intent to broaden it. Did you get it too broad? Is that what happened in the Dash and Freeze?
I think we may have been out a little too clever, and we can draw that.
Whoops.
To be quite frank with the chair.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not trying to be clever. We're just trying to be helpful here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Beck.
I have another question, differing, distinguishing two, between the two drafts. The original resolution seems to be clear in allowing property taxes to be the source of funds to pay off the debt, and the amendments seem to explicitly prevent. I'd be curious as to, other than the obvious, whether there are any other reason why prohibit ad valorem tax.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beck, the original draft was a placeholder, and so that's why, hence the refinements in the Dash 3. I worked with Chuck Smith in my office, and we went out and looked to see, is that a credit feature that we had to have? I mean, that, in essence, when you look at the other amendments in the Constitution, that's implicit in the bonding itself. It's not necessary, and so to me, why put it in there? Because it's not necessary for us to go to the market and still get the good capital raise. So, it, you know, I don't know why it was put in initially. I don't know the legislative history behind those programs, but it's not necessary.
Would this measure then prohibit the use of state property tax to sort of going? Could we? So this would prohibit us using property tax to pay off the debt. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Do you not? Why would you take that flexibility or that tool away unless you just think it will lack public support? I mean, is it really basic? Would you like the tool if the voters would approve it?
I guess my point, Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, it's not necessary. And let me just say from the history, even though that feature has been in all our other bonds, we've never called upon it. So almost all our GO bonds, again, there's only about two places in the Constitution that we actually look for revenues from you to pay them off rather than, say, a highway general obligation bond, which is tied to taxes generated from a gas tax. We have never called on a statewide property tax. It's just a backup that in case you don't pay or we don't pay, mm-hmm. we can assess that. That's all it does.
Representative Bates, are you still in the queue?
Yes.
Okay, then Representative Williams, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to read through this and make some sense of it. We've had some changes here. I understand the proposal that grants would be actually be given, which would be paid back into bonds by general fund money. And my question about that is, where's the limit going to be, and who decides what district gets it, and what if a district has just financed a whole new $30 million bond levy, and then the next year this bill comes out, can they refinance our old bonds, allowed to be refinanced under this program, and ask for grants at the same time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, a number of questions in there, and what you're getting at really is the next part of the legislation, 3370, which implements this. What this provides is the overall framework by which we can go out and issue general obligation bonds for K through 12 financing and other purposes. Again, you've got to decide the policy about what you're going to use this tool for. You asked a question about the limitation. This does have a general cap of 1% of all market value of state property taxes. That's a feature. When you look at the other bonds in the Constitution that we have, there's a general limitation on how many of these bonds you can issue based on that, and that's 1% of the statewide market value of property. So there is an overall cap on how much you could issue under this program.
Representative Williams.
Actually, Representative Bates got into my question, so I'm fine, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to jump back to the flexibility issue in there and just comment that the examples you used of where you needed flexibility sounded like they were educational public purposes. I mean, they weren't just any public purpose. They were public purpose-related education. Is that a true statement?
Mr. Chair, no. Representative Carlson, part of the... Obviously, part of this bill does talk about K through 12. Higher ed could use this. We could use it for, we need more prison expansion. We could use this tool for that. So it is a variety of public purposes, park expansion. Part of my testimony talked about, we have used lottery-backed bonds to finance many of those projects, sort of as a, if you will, a way to get us to meet some of these other outside of, even outside of K through 12 needs, use lottery-backed bonds. What we're suggesting, particularly, in fact, in light of the fact that lottery-backed bonds are likely to be our capacity issue anymore for the next, if we do what I believe is likely to happen this session, we won't be able to use that tool for another 4 or 5 biennia. We need another tool, and that's what we're looking for here.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I guess my gut reaction, though, is that if this were sent out to the voters, it would probably be more saleable if it were limited to educational purposes, at least, and then maybe you could expand on that. That's just my sense. When we're talking about, when Representative Beck was talking about the obvious on the property taxes, I can sort of hear, you know, here comes the state, and they're asking for this open checkbook sort of to go out and just do pretty much anything. But if it were limited education, mm-hmm. I think that really would have a better play in the public. That's just one person's opinion.
Okay.
We have nothing else.
Nothing else. All right. Thank you very much. If you do you want to wait and let me get through the rest of the witnesses on this before you come back up on 3370?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's bring up a panel here: Terry Thompson, Gary Conkling, Jim Walker.
First, I'm short.
Thank you. I'm the past representative from District 4, Terry Thompson. I want to make just a couple brief comments and first congratulate Randall Edwards, because when he was a freshman, came in the legislature, we talked about the problem of public schools and what the problems were on the coast and what the problems were in downtown Portland were somewhat similar, and that was being able to pass bond measures that in those areas of poverty or in, like on the coast, where we have a high number of senior citizens who have limited fixed incomes. And so today, this culminates what started over 6 years ago when he first came in office. So I congratulate him for bringing this forward. What we'd all like to do is have a good, equal, high-quality education for every student in the state of Oregon. And what this will do is give us the ability to move toward that goal. I hope that you will pass this bill. There's one particular interest that I find that I think it has potential to solve in our area. There's areas all over the state. Each of them are different. Ours is that we have some schools that are located in tsunami zones that have where we have grade schools that could potentially be inundated by a tsunami. We hope that if this money is created, it would give us the ability to stimulate the taxpayers in our area to be willing to build new schools out of those zones. So I hope you'll pass this bill.
Gary.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, appearing here today on behalf of the Beaverton School District. Members of this committee are familiar with the challenges of high-growth school districts such as Beaverton. We have added a net of more than 6,250 students in the last decade. And if that new enrollment formed a separate district, it would be the size of Lake Oswego or Lincoln County or Corvallis or Centennial or Oregon City. Enrollment projections indicate Beaverton will add another 8,000 students by 2010, a 40% increase. The sheer weight of this enrollment growth has turned Beaverton into a developer. We're in the market constantly for land for school sites, usually competing toe-to-toe with residential, commercial, and industrial brokers vying for scarce remaining parcels. This competition has driven up prices to more than $300,000 per acre. And, of course, we build schools, on average, one every year. Beaverton patrons have approved five bond measures in the last decade, totaling $480 million. The property tax rate to pay for these bonds now stands at $6.12 for $1,000 of assessed valuation. When new schools open, we face significant costs for computers, desks, instructional materials, school buses, and because of our growth, often portable classrooms for the new school. Facility factor in the state school formula was created to cover these costs. But this biennium, Beaverton and other school districts with new school facilities only received a pro rata share of the grant. Next biennium, the fractional share we are projected to receive may be even less. For all these reasons, Beaverton has been a persistent and, as some of you know, even annoying voice for added tools to pay for new school construction. State-issued bonds are such a tool. This isn't the tool we ourselves have proposed, but we favor any tool we can get, and the sooner the better. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Walker.
And Mr. Chair, member of the Procurement Committee, my name is Jim Walker, and I'm the Executive Vice President of Oregon Health Sciences University. OHSU would like to testify strongly in behalf of HJR 46. As Randall Edwards has testified, OHSU has a bill before the Senate, Senate Bill 832, which is a $200 million investment into the expansion of the research and outreach of OHSU and the effect that will have for the state as a whole in the area of biotechnology. As we started looking at this about a year and a half ago, there are about six or eight other states that have strong research institutions, such as OHSU. The funding that is coming from the tobacco settlement has spurred a lot of those states to make this investment in their academic institutions for the same reasons that is outlined in our bill. As we started looking with the Treasury Office about what that would cost, you know, and stuff, if there was $200 million issued on that investment, it became very obvious internally and also talking with other states, the best way to serve that and the best way to issue those bonds is through general obligation bonds of the state. When you look at the different array of tax-exempt issues that you can do. So there is strong support for Senate Bill 32. It appears to be going through the process very well. And this HJR 46 would allow the cost of that investment to be as small as possible.
Yes, Mr. Walker, that $200 million for Oregon Opportunity, is that capital expense or is that other than capital expense?
That is, the vast majority of it is for capital expense. There is for the buildings, for the equipment, for computers, mm-hmm. or such like that. There are some soft costs, as you would call for the build-out of the research.
Questions for any of these witnesses? Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much. Bring up Ozzie Rose and John Marshall. Oh, I'm sorry. I got a note. I'm sorry. Yeah, Representative Worth is... Oh, I'm sorry. come back up. This is kind of fun. It's almost...
Go again.
Yeah.
Go
ahead. No, go back 5 steps.
Mother, may I?
Chairman, may I?
I apologize.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I insist that Kelly Worth come up here now.
Overruled.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And this is the latest in the session I've ever appeared before the House Revenue Committee, and maybe I'm glad the way it's run that I haven't been here earlier, but...
Whoa! And he wants what?
Right, and I want what?
Remember that when we spoke before me a little bit.
Is that 5-1?
going.
Sinelli has a lot to offer. COSA supports HR 46 and 3370. We have a serious infrastructure problem in our schools, from the growth side of our state and from the rest of our state. And this is not a problem just for our state. This is a common problem across these United States. We built huge, huge infrastructure for schools in the 50s and 60s. And since then have not kept up with what ought to be done in terms of maintenance and refurbishing. And the national problem is beginning to be addressed and talked about at Congress, but there's no real meaningful assistance, I believe, from that level. But I just want on the record that we're not unique in this area. Oregon's problem is also brought to light in a different way in the fact that in this past decade, we've also moved from a system in which most of our funding for schools was paid for the local taxpayers, and now it's paid for through the general fund. And you're all have been around long enough to know what we've gone through in this decade. And we've moved toward equity in the operations of our schools as the state has picked up a larger and larger share of the cost. Throughout that discussion, for those of you who have been here a while, you know that we've always talked about we're addressing equity in terms of the operations of our schools, but one of these days we're going to have to sit down and look at our infrastructure needs and address that equity question as well, or get the state involved in some meaningful partnership with local districts in developing their infrastructure. And our infrastructure is, again, it's not just a new building. It's a building that now has technology that can be used. It's wired properly, et cetera, to meet the educational programs in those schools. Our buildings issue is the older building that we've deferred the maintenance on because we didn't want to increase class size and so forth. The infrastructure issue is related. There's ongoing maintenance, there's deferred maintenance, and there's building new buildings. And as you don't take care of your deferred maintenance for whatever reason, you increase the cost of your ongoing maintenance. And so our districts who have had to defer maintenance have very critical problems in terms of how much of their operating budget they're currently spending on maintenance. HJR 46 and 3370 is a step toward creating this partnership that we believe is necessary, one, to have the funds that are available, and two, to address the question of equity. One of the problems with trying to talk about the issue is that there is no real good database about how big the problem is. Three years ago, in the interim between the last two sessions, there was an effort to look at this kind of problem, and I appeared before that advisory committee right after higher ed had appeared before. And higher ed, which is a single organization, had a very, very detailed inventory of their infrastructure issues. K-12, where we have 198 school districts, we don't have such an inventory. During the last session, Senator Castile, I worked with her a little bit, and we tried to run a bill that would have created an effort to get that inventory done. And we ran into architects who told us it would cost $3 and $4 million to conduct the right kind of inventory, and that wasn't doable. But we went then last spring, tried to do an inventory of what are your infrastructure needs. I won't allege that it's scientific. We got 46 districts to respond out of 198 in our effort. But of those 46 districts, which are about 23% of the total districts, there was an unfunded need for capital in excess of $2 billion. So we know that the problem, and again, you talk about the need for seismic upgrade, the need for technology, the need for replacing and repairing buildings that have been around,
We have districts in which there are no buildings that are as young as you folks at this table. And all those issues need to be addressed. The other side of the coin is if we enter into a situation where there is the state in a partnership with our local districts as proposed in these two bills, and in the bills, I've already discussed a little bit, the district must make the first effort, and it sets up a matching grant concept. Will help districts with their effort to get measures passed. If they can go to the public and say, we make this kind of effort, the state's going to step in and assist us. Over the last 3 years, 72 different districts have placed bond issues before the people. 34 of those districts placed them multiple times. 9 of them placed their measure up 3 times. And 5 of those finally passed on the third try. All in all, the 115 measures have been on the ballot in the last 3 years. 51 have passed and 64 have failed. So just less than half of them actually passed. We believe that if there were a partnership and if we were able to say to the folks, this kind of effort will get this kind of return, it would assist us in getting approval at the local level. The other side of that coin is the issue of equity. And the bill, and when you get to 3370, talks about the matching grant will run from 10 to 50% of whatever it is that your project is. And therein will lie the ability to help the poorer school districts by giving them a larger grant on a percentage basis than the richer districts. And we think this is a necessary component of this effort, just like it is in the local option. And we encourage you to move both of these bills and give us at least the opportunity to take these ideas to the people in not only a statewide vote for the HJR, but then in later votes when we actually district by district try to address these problems. I will answer any questions if you have any.
Let's take John's testimony and then come back to questions for both.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I just wanted to underscore a few things that Ozzy said. First and foremost, I think is a burgeoning issue, facilities equity. We dealt with the operational equity significantly over the decade of the 90s, and now there's a wide disparity in facilities existing in school districts. There are 198 school districts and 198 separate circumstances. Many of you, of course, are from very fast-growing school districts where school buildings can't be built fast enough. We have property-rich and property-poor school districts where a tax rate to build a middle school is vastly different from one community to another. There are many school districts with newer facilities that require ongoing maintenance. Other school districts have facilities that are deteriorating and need a great deal of upgrading. The idea of a state-local partnership, I think, is one worthy of consideration. By creating a process to allow for matching funds, it can totally change the political dynamic when school districts go to their local voters for bond measures. I don't think any of us should be fooled into thinking that these bills will create a pot of money significant to solve every single facilities problem in 198 school districts forever. But it will create an opportunity, I think, for school districts to go to their patrons in their own communities and suggest that if you give us 50 cents, for example, we can get a dollar. And so I think that's extremely valuable. Again, this is a tool, and we think it's worthy of your consideration and would urge your support.
Let me ask both of you, your testimony, of course, is focused on the capital construction, and I don't know if you've seen the Dash 3s. You've probably heard the testimony about those, which, at least by the terms of the language of the Dash 3s, expand the bonding authority beyond capital construction for schools. And I guess looking beyond this building to a product that has to be voted on and approved by the voters of the state of Oregon, how do you see that affecting the likely reception the voters might give this? Is it better to narrow it to facilities for schools or to expand it beyond facilities just for schools or beyond facilities for any public purpose?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ozzy Rose again, we'll support the measure either way. I guess my stomach tells me that there's quite a bit of appeal, and if it's aimed at schools. I also know that the state has broader needs than just the schools, so I don't know how to balance that.
Okay. All right, anything else for these two? Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I kind of understand this. I'm not sure that I do. I'm going to give you a couple of hypothetical cases, so maybe you can make it simpler for me. School district just passes its own bond. It's the first bond it's passed in 20 years. Next district over does the same thing, but now they have an option of getting some grant money, and they pass a bond issue, and so their taxpayers are going to pay against that bond issue at a lower figure because they've got grant money from the state. But the first district's taxpayers are going to pay the full bore for their bond issue, and their personal income tax are going to help pay the district next door's bond issue in a roundabout, circuitous way. Is that scenario possible in this bill?
Mr. Chair, I would assume you can't refinance, but I noticed the treasurer didn't answer that question. Ask him, so I don't know the answer to that question. My own answer to the problem is timing's everything, and unfortunately, they passed theirs. That's the way life is. We move on, but I don't think you would want to use up your bonding capacity to refinance what's already passed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, in discussions that we've had surrounding this issue that began, I would guess, probably a year ago, the focus has always been on distribution. And we're very skilled at coming up with means by which to distribute a limited pot of money. And I think one of the issues that we discussed was the possibility that a portion of the funds that are available would go to all school districts on perhaps a per-student basis that could then be used, for example, for a facilities construction or in a circumstance where a school district just got a bond measure passed, they could use some of those proceeds to reduce the debt service load that's currently being carried by their patrons. And as we get into figuring out how to distribute the pot, I think it would be reasonable to look at some of those options so that the issue of, well, darn, if we'd only waited a month or a year to go out with our bond measure, we'd be in much better circumstance than we are given the time we went. So I think that's certainly some issues that should be on the table for discussion.
Thank you for acknowledging that issue.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much. Let's move on. Ellen Maddox.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I signed it wrong for the
Oh, okay. That's fine. You want to testify, I'm going to guess, on 3400.
Correct, sir.
Okay, I'll add you to 3400. Good, we're short of people to testify. Lori, I'm sorry, Representative Worth, I want to get you before I forget myself again.
Taking my chance to go before us.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't know. Chair, I'd also like to introduce Robert Baldwin, who's a member of our school board in Corvallis, joining me here for technical expertise.
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Worth, and I represent the District 35, which is Corvallis, basically the city limits of Corvallis. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you here today about H.J.R. 46 and House Bill 3370 that authorizes the state to issue general obligation bonds to assist local school districts with capital construction and maintenance needs. School districts clearly across the state are facing enormous capital costs. Some districts need to build additional capacity because of growth. Others face massive upgrade costs. And all schools must determine whether or not the retrofitting requirements for seismic preparedness impact them. I'd like to give you an idea of in Corvallis, since we recently went through a facility study for all our school district buildings to give you an idea of what we are facing. We recently undertook a building study of, like I said, all the school district buildings, and the results of the study was a sobering fact that our school district faces capital improvement costs ranging from $120 million to $150 million over the next 10 years. Two of the three middle schools in Corvallis are among the five buildings that have been identified as high risk for earthquake damage. So we're now going through this gut-wrenching process of planning the closure of two of these middle schools and building a new middle school to serve approximately 800 students. The $30 million required to build this new school is actually less than what it would cost to repair the two old existing buildings. And one of our only two high schools has also been determined to be especially vulnerable to severe damage in the event of a moderate earthquake, as well as not being equipped to serve the needs of a 21st century high school. A $60 million bond would be required to cover replacement costs for this high school and make necessary upgrades to the only other high school in Corvallis. So even in Corvallis, where I'm sure you've heard jokingly, we always say we never met a tax that we didn't like. We cannot afford these costly improvements, certainly not within the next 10-year span of time. So the House Joint Resolution 46 and House Bill 3370 provide a potential source to help for capital improvement costs for not only Corvallis School District, but school districts across Oregon. I think Ozzy mentioned that local taxpayers will be much more likely to support a local school bond if some of the amount is to be paid for or kicked in by state matching dollars. And in addition, funding a portion of our capital construction costs for schools will free up additional local dollars for other essential service needs. I just want to emphasize that equipping the state with this general obligation bond tool will help the school districts throughout Oregon meet their critical capital needs, but it also provides a rare opportunity for the state and local jurisdictions to really demonstrate a partnership to help Oregon schools. And I really urge your support on both of these measures and would be happy to answer any questions. And like I said earlier, this is Robert Baldwin, who definitely has the expertise of what's going on in Corvallis as a school board member and can tell you how gut-wrenching this process is about closing schools and consolidating.
Mr. Baldwin, do you want to add anything?
Not unless you have questions.
Okay. Any questions for either Representative Worth or Mr. Baldwin? All right, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Jean Thorne, did I see you come into the back of the room? Okay, why don't you come on up and... There you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Thorne, the Governor's Education and Workforce Policy Advisor. I'd just like to add the Governor's support to HGR 46 and House Bill 3370 as really being an important first step in trying to deal with the K-12 infrastructure needs. Last year, the Governor asked me to convene a work group of K-12 community colleges and higher ed to try to get a better sense of what the infrastructure needs were out there and possibly how we might be able to address them. By the time we were done with the first part, which is determining how big the need was, we kind of weren't able to do much beyond that, although we do have a bill that would outline a program if funding were available. Ozzy mentioned the survey that was done. Actually, I count up. I think we had 80 responses from 80 school districts, so I think represented about 50 or 60% of the students. And although it was self-administered, there were a number of categories that they were asked to respond to. When consultants took that and extrapolated it further, they estimated that on K-12, the total backlog needs were estimated at about $1.8 billion, that the annual renewal needs, which is the amount that might be necessary to keep the backlog from growing, was about $188 million. And the projected need for new buildings over the next 10 years or new infrastructure is about $1.8 billion. So as a consultant who spoke to one of the interim committees said, you don't especially need an inventory in order to get a sense of a policy. So if we're off a few hundred million, we still know it's a big problem. Obviously, the issue of infrastructure has been an important one, and I think as you've heard from others, as squeezes have occurred over the last decade, in terms of financing for schools, the imperative has been on the classroom and keeping teachers in the classroom and instruction, and so in many cases the infrastructure needs have gone by the wayside. And the ability of K-12 districts to meet these infrastructure needs is different based on both the willingness of voters to pass a levy, but also the price of them. And so, for instance, and for those of you who remember back to when we talked about local option, given the different property wealth at the high end of the spectrum, Black Butte School District for a levy of 10 cents per thousand could raise the equivalent of $137 per student. The other end is Nyssa, and for 10 cents per thousand, they could raise $12 per student. So the issue of equity on the bonding side is, and on the construction side is a very important one as well. And so we're pleased that in House Bill 3700, it allows for matching and that the criteria would be based on the property or would include consideration of the property wealth of the school district, because we think that is important to the equity discussion. Would like I haven't heard all the other speakers, so I'm not sure if this came up before, though. The bonding authority is a first step, and I think we need to recognize it's a first step. In the work group we convened to look at these issues, we kept coming back to what's the revenue source. And with a need that is that big, we kept looking at revenue sources and realized we had basically tapped out. You're dealing with issues around the general fund. The lottery bonding authority is close to being tapped out. And with this size of need, it really probably will likely require some kind of dedicated revenue source. I recognize the bill allows for general fund, perhaps tobacco settlement, and then another category. It will be necessary, we believe, in the future to address that issue. But in the meantime, we think establishing that authority is a good first step towards developing a long-term strategy of looking at how the state can partner with local school districts around these issues.
Thank you, Gene. Representative Williams.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene, I guess I'm a little surprised, maybe not too surprised, but I did notice that in the actual version of the amendments to H.J.R. 46 that we're looking at, it specifically references the tobacco master settlement agreement revenues, which, at least as currently drafted, could be entirely subsumed, for example, as a source of revenue funding for bonds, which, as the amendments are drafted, would be for essentially any public purpose deemed worthy by the legislature. Previously, the governor's position on this has been primarily health-related issues only, maybe a little for education under the "we got to find it somewhere" argument. Has there been a policy change in the governor's office with respect to uses of the tobacco master settlement agreement money?
No, Mr. Chair, and Representative Williams, I think the language, and I think they're the same amendments I saw some drafts of, since it does reflect, it could be this or it could be that, or it could be, I mean, there are a number of sources that are possibilities for funding this. And I haven't had discussions in the last week or two, but I don't believe there has been any change generally in terms of the governor's support for focusing tobacco settlement monies on health-related or some kind of health-related purpose primarily, and although he does have education in there. But I think that the bill as written does not specify that would have to be those, but that could be one of the mechanisms in the future that the legislature might choose.
So if we were to go forward, if I could, Mr.
Yes, sure.
If we were to go forward with this plan and adopt the resolution, refer it out, it passes, and the implementing statutory language, and then also move forward with OHSU's opportunity fund and tied its entire payment to the master settlement agreement. Would the governor support that approach? Is that tied close enough to health care in his mind or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, the governor actually in his budget recommended utilizing tobacco settlement money for OHSU as the revenue stream. I have not been working specifically on the OHSU proposal recently, but that was part of that would be $10 million per year as a revenue stream.
So not the full amount, but a $10 million allocation.
That's what is in his budget.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Gene. Just got a couple more witnesses on H.J.R. 46 and 3, actually. Let me bring them up together. Lori Wimmer-Whalen, Marlene Payne, and David Williams. Let's have you come on up, too, and we'll finish off the testimony on H.J.R. 46. Go ahead, Lori.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. Happy to be a proponent for the change. We're here in support of the Oregon Education Association and its 43,000 members of H.J.R. 46 and its companion H.B. 3370. I'd like to make a couple quick points and then introduce to you one of our members who's come from Beaverton to tell you a little bit about their circumstances and why we are in support of the bill. First of all, our support is based on everything you've previously heard, so I will very quickly summarize. We believe that this is the least expensive way to address Oregon's infrastructure needs, especially for K-12 education, which we believe is truly deserving of some attention for all the equity and infrastructure decay reasons that you all know so well. We believe that it will save millions of dollars to taxpayers to address the situation this way, both in the high growth areas and in places where they've deferred the maintenance on their capital properties because of budget issues, trying to front-end load in the classroom, keep class size down, keep staff hired, keep the education itself that takes place in those buildings coming. We believe that that particularly is important to as we said, again, with the local option equalization question earlier in this session, we believe that when the state is able to offer matching dollars where needed in communities, that that is an enticement to voters to pass bonds locally because they believe that they're, in effect, leveraging their dollars in a way that otherwise wouldn't be possible. I remember one time being a guest in Lebanon at the high school for their government class, and as I was walking down the hall, a plate glass window fell in, very nearly harming several of the students in the hall ahead of me. And I thought it was a rather traumatic event, but apparently rather frequently happened, that it was a single pane glass, and fortunately nobody had been hurt. They were the lucky students. Down the way, the elementary school had been condemned, and all the students there were in trailers on the site. It took them 3 attempts in that community because of their own economic issues inside the community to actually pass a bond, and it was a great deal of struggle. And so we believe that this is a way to ameliorate those kinds of situations, particularly in the lower-income communities of Oregon, but also in the high-growth districts, and we believe, once again, that it is a better idea for addressing the high-growth community needs than some of the other proposals in the building that would, I think, mechanically, more clumsily address that issue.
Lori, let me ask, the Dash 3 amendments refer in language to use of the bond proceeds for capital construction for K through 12 public schools, but then it also says, and any other public purpose, which really means, I think to me, that suggests the language referring to capital use or the public schools use is almost surplusage, because what it really says is it can be used for any purpose the legislature deems. Does that give you any pause in terms of your testimony doesn't square, I guess, with the language of the literal language of the resolutions before us in the Dash 3s?
Chair Shetterly, thank you for the question. It was the first question I asked when I saw the original intent as well, and it was, to be honest, a question that we had. I suppose I would say that because this, it is the obligation of the state to fund core programs across a spectrum of issues and need areas, it's a little like a walnut shell game, if you will. The needs continue to exist. They must be funded out of one pot of money or another, and I'm a little less uncomfortable, as it's been explained to me, that this mechanism could be used for things other than K-12 in theory in the future at some point, knowing that those needs don't go away and would come out of another pot, and we are also a general fund agency. 70% of the education dollar comes from general fund. And so, once again, it's another venue for us to take our fair share of. With that, if you would, wouldn't mind, I'd like to introduce Marlene.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. I'm a middle school teacher in the Beaverton School District on leave as the association president. I can speak from my personal observations of 28 years in the Beaverton schools, and also I hear from a lot of the teachers in our overcrowded schools. I was raised in Southwest Portland, and when I was young, my 86-year-old grandfather used to say to me, "Look at all those wheat fields," as we'd drive him home up Vermont Street, and we'd laugh and think it was kind of funny. However, now the sixth graders that I teach say, "You know, I can remember when there used to be cows and horses in the fields over by where we live," and that's a change in Beaverton in just their 10 small years or less. Findlay Elementary, Oregon's largest overcrowded elementary school, opened its doors 4 years ago and now has nearly, quite close to, 1,000 students. Their 8 sections of kindergarten have been located off campus at Kinder Village for 2 of those years. This Kinder campus is about 2 miles away from their main building and is composed of all portable classrooms. Teachers and families must communicate and travel back and forth between the two on many occasions throughout each day, week, or year. A new school will open in that spot in September of 2001 to relieve the overcrowding at Findlay. It will open at about 90% capacity already. Beaverton will have built 5 new schools in 5 years, 3 new elementary schools, a middle school, and a high school, and we continue to need more schools. Along with the enormous amount of new growth that we have in Beaverton, we also have many schools that were built in the 1950s or before. Beaverton and other high growth areas need dollars not only to help with the new buildings of the growth that you've heard, but also with the deferred maintenance in our older schools. Since Measure 5, Beaverton has gone to the voters on 8 occasions to levy construction bonds. On 5 occasions, we've been grateful of our voters to support our schools. And today, I would ask you to help support us with matching funds so that it will help with the growth and the deferred maintenance. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Williams. I'm here today representing the Oregon School Employees Association. OSCA is a union of more than 19,000 classified professionals in Oregon's K-12, ESD, Community College, Parks and Rec, and Head Start districts. I'm officially signed up as neutral on this, and the two reasons are OSCA is in favor of HGR 46 as it is printed. However, we would not be supportive of the Dash 3 amendments for the concerns that the chair has pointed out in adding the or other public purposes. We feel that it creates a constitutional amendment that is broad and too divergent from its original purpose of supporting K-12 capital needs. And I want to keep this short, and that's all I have. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Your neutrality is duly noted. Any questions for these three witnesses? All right, thank you very much, all of you. With that, I will close the public hearing on on HJR 46 and open directly a public hearing on House Bill 3370. And again, in the interest of time, see, why don't we just invite the treasurer back up with his entourage to lead us through House Bill 3370. And welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, for the sake of time, I'll be brief in my comments. Again, for the record, my name is State Treasurer Randall Edwards, and I appreciate the opportunity again to talk to you about House Bill 3370, which is one of the ways in which you could implement House Joint Resolution 46 should that become law. And I think the testimony you heard today is really part of the thrust behind helping schools, and that is we in the state have been focused on the operating side of schools since ballot measure 5. The issue of the capital needs of the state are growing, and something that is the other shoe, the funding shoe, that we have not really taken care of or really taken a serious look at. And what this resolution and what this implementing bill does is begin a point in which the state can be, as you heard in other testimony, to be a partner to help school districts meet their capital needs. I have seen firsthand, traveling around the state, some of those needs, whether that's Evergreen Elementary School in Redmond, a two-story building that was built years ago, cannot accommodate children in wheelchairs. So every year, teachers have to switch classrooms to accommodate these children as they go through the school. You heard about the fast-growing districts in Beaverton and Hillsboro. Lake Oswego High School, one of the located in one of the most affluent school parts of the state, was so poorly designed, and I've seen this. I was there after they did this. They had to jackhammer a concrete floor to do some basic maintenance on the facility. Again, you've heard as well, old buildings that were built years ago. We have seismic needs, upgrading, and, of course, the issue of just meeting a quality education that we're demanding of our schools. Again, this is a simple piece of legislation that does, there were some questions specific about what do we do about school districts, should they have already passed a measure. I think the point that was driven earlier was we've got to start somewhere and we need to start now. That doesn't mean to say that in the end we couldn't accommodate those school districts that may have passed a measure near to the implementing of both HJR and this bill. But the point is we need to have a point in which we move forward. We have not moved forward in this realm. It is time the state step up and become a long-term partner. Specifically, the bill does talk about equity. It talks about how the state would provide grants from a range between 10% and 50% of the cost of capital. If you're in an area where I live in Portland, you would receive less money from the state. If you're in Coos Bay, you would receive more. I have seen firsthand as well communities which have been able to pass bond measures. And I got to say, it's a revitalization of the school and the communities that are around it. Hedrick Middle School in Bedford, I think, is a great example of refinancing and reinvesting in its school down in Medford, which, again, the community, when I went to that school, was extremely proud of this rebirth of their local school. I believe these two bills in and of themselves are a beginning point of a discussion. The tool that I've been asking for, that we as a state need, is embedded in HJR 46. House Bill 3370 is one way in which you can implement that new tool should it become law. I also want to say that we could have a discussion, and I'd be happy to look work with you in before we have another hearing on this, about how we might accommodate the breadth of the resolution, if that's a concern. But I want to say that Oregon Health Sciences University is in need of some financing, and I will argue that this is the best tool for us as a state to do it, should you decide to go that route. Again, I'm here to answer any questions. Again, I appreciate the time. I know it's been you're pressed. You've got a lot of people here today, and be happy to talk to you either today or individually in the future about how we might make this work for the state.
Let me ask before we take questions if either of your colleagues has any additional testimony. So, yeah.
Chair Shetterly, if I could just address going back direct in the proposed amendments, direct the chair's attention to public school capital costs on page 2,
line 18, line,
18 and 20, and at least in my version, and I may have an older version, 21 through, and then page 5, lines 26 through 28, which we, the intent was to make clear that the proceeds of the bonds could only be used for capital purposes and could not be used, for example, to refinance local school district bonds, but only to do new projects going forward.
Let me ask how sections 10 and 11 work together here. Section 10 appropriates $100 million for the 2001-03 biennium. It may be expended for the payment of debt service. So that sounds to me like we're putting money, general fund money, into this fund before any bond proceeds get in. But then Section 11 says the act doesn't become effective until HJR 46 passes. How do those two interplay?
Mr. Smith, I don't know. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I arrived in a plane back late from vacation last night, and I don't have that page on my facts.
Well, you're looking, where was vacation?
You don't ask. Augusta, Georgia.
Oh, from the same brand.
Do you know how those two are? Just are we asking Ways and Means to appropriate $100 million to park that into a bill that may or may not become effective depending on the outcome of a public vote?
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. What we've done here is earmarked $100 million, which would be the amount of bonds that we would issue. At least that was the intent. I honestly haven't looked whether that language jives with the intent, which is basically, if HJR 46 becomes law, then the next, when available, the state would, we could issue up to $100 million to begin helping meet this financial need in the state. So it's a cap to begin the process. And I guess I want to underscore, this is a long-term need in the state. This was just a shot to begin a funding, and I understand this legislative session is very tight with money. So we put something in there just to show that, you know, here's what we would issue, and again, kind of a rule of thumb, somewhere under this GEO proposal, that would probably be about $8 million per year to debt service that $100
million. Mr. Godian?
I don't really have, I agree with that.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. Any questions for these gentlemen? All right, Skip Lieberts, you'd signed up on 3370. You want to come on up? Let me ask while he's coming. Ozzy, did you have anything else to add on this bill? Okay. We'll see. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. I do appreciate this opportunity to testify. by, and I will be brief. I know you have a full agenda yet. I'm here to encourage you to support House Bill 3370, and I would like to share with you that this has an impact all across the state of Oregon. When you look at Oregon schools, you see a pretty interesting picture. We have 198 school districts in this state, and more than 50% of those school districts are tiny. They have less than 1,000 students in them. And when you have a school district of less than 1,000 students, you have typically a 1A or a 2A high school, a single middle school or junior high, and then a couple of elementary schools, down to school districts that are one school building. And when you visit those smallest schools, you see some incredible deficiencies in their facilities and their ability to provide programs for youngsters. The same is true in very large school districts, and you've heard a number of those from a number of those already today on this bill. When you're growing or when you're declining in enrollment, your facility needs become very, very large in terms of the cost. During the past 10 years, I've served as the superintendent of schools of Lincoln County School District and also of Corvallis School District. And you heard testimony from the Corvallis School District. They have a tremendous problem when you look at their middle schools with their tip-up cement walls that would automatically collapse in an earthquake. They need to do something about that. Their voters have been tremendously supportive of that school district, and yet they have needs that are not yet dealt with. When I was hired as superintendent of schools in Lincoln County, we had three buildings that were more than 75 years old. And the capital needs in that school district were tremendous. And the voters there very generously supported a $39 million bond measure. And at that time, we were still able to identify more than $100 million worth of needs in Lincoln County. And despite that building program, which has given them several very nice schools, the halls at Walport Middle or High School still open up when the tide is high and the rain is heavy. The main hall of that building still opens up and water runs down the main hall at Walport High School. The capital needs in our school districts across this state are tremendous. And I salute State Treasurer Edwards for proposing a unique way, a partnership way, that local school districts, their patrons, can join together and meet some of these additional capital needs. So I'd urge your support. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions, Chair? Yes, Representative Brown.
It's good to see you, Skip. You're looking good. You know, you were just a man way ahead of your time. You got that $39 million bond measure passed for us over there a few years too soon.
Yeah.
But maybe we can get some help. Anyway, thank you.
Representative Carlson.
I, too, would like to welcome Mr. Liebers because he is now our superintendent here for Willamette ESD. But I just wanted to ask you, I appreciate your testimony, and you bring a wealth of perspective and experience to this. We were talking earlier, and I know we're on a different bill now, but since it's related to the prior bill that we talked about the public purpose part of it, the broadening, and you've done a lot of work with the voters, first of all. And second of all, I was curious, we've heard from higher ed that education service districts, it seems, may have capital needs as well. If we limited it to an educational purpose or whatever, would that, I mean, would there be a reason for doing that? Could you comment on that?
Selfishly, Chair Shetterly, Representative Carlson, selfishly, I believe that the needs in education are ones that I know on a very firsthand basis, and I've seen the impact on youngsters. And so selfishly, I'd probably jump to, the needs are so great, I'd love to see it limited to K-12 education. At the same time, I know that there are tremendous other needs around the state. And so I guess I would take what you all would be the greater experts in, which is the political side of things. And I don't know what's most saleable to the citizens of our state. I believe that there's good support for education. And I think that's not just K-12, it's also higher education. So I don't really have a strong opinion about what's the most feasible way to go. I'd probably end up with some kind of political answer, which is whatever would be most saleable would be what I would support. I know the education needs firsthand. I don't know those others other than as an observer.
Okay, thank you, Skip.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3400. I'm sorry, I heard that. 3370.
Just seeing if there was.
No.
Just testing you.
Thank you all for coming. And I have been promised a short hearing on House Bill 2908. So let me bring up Liz Beth. And I don't have a sign-up sheet. Okay.
Did you bring the bill up? It wasn't on my agenda.
Thank you very much. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2908. And Elizabeth, would you give us the overview?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2908, what you have is this bill is expanding the 10-year property tax exemption for single-family housing in distressed areas, single-unit housing to include condominiums. It extends the sunset on the property tax exemption for single housing in distressed areas to January 1st, 2012. It applies to property taxes beginning on or after July 1st, 2002. So the 1989 Oregon legislature enacted a 10-year property tax exemption for new houses in distressed areas in Oregon. And to qualify for that exemption, the single family dwelling had to be constructed before January 1st, 2003. And it had to be used as a dwelling for a person or just one family. Only the property taxes of the dwelling is exempt. The land is fully taxable. The city has to adopt an ordinance which designates one or more distressed areas within the city, and it grants a property tax exemption of the city taxes only. To receive a complete property tax exemption for a family home in the distressed area, at least 51% of the taxing districts in the distressed city must grant this property tax exemption by ordinance. Annually, the city will establish a maximum average real market value per dwelling, which each new home must not exceed. The property owner applies to the city for approval for this tax exemption. Currently, the city of Portland is the only city which has adopted this property tax exemption. In 2001, there were roughly 1,220 new homes in Portland that had been approved for this 10-year property tax exemption. And it was roughly about $1,256 per home with a tax exemption. So basically, with the two components, you have the extension of the sunset on the property tax exemption for single-family homes. And if you assume approximately 100 new single-family homes would be granted a property tax exemption each year, beginning in 2003-04, this would be a reduction in local revenues in Multnomah County by $137,500 from extending the sunset.
But only if they want it.
But only if they want it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And also extending the property tax exemption to condominiums would further reduce property tax revenues. The City of Portland has approved two smaller condominium complexes for the property tax exemption for a total assessed value of $1.17 million. And approximately $26,162 in property tax revenues, which would begin in 2002-03. So it's uncertain at this point exactly how much the revenue impact reduction would be. It depends on how many condominiums are to be approved in those distressed areas, as well as if there would be any other cities besides Portland which would want to adopt these ordinances.
Thank you. Marge Kafori and Mike Saba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland. I'd like to thank Ms. Martin for giving our testimony. We'd be happy to answer any questions. I promised less than 5 minutes, and we intend to stick with that. I'd like to introduce Mike Saba, who is senior planner with the Bureau of Planning, City of Portland, who will very briefly walk you through this bill.
Saba.
Very briefly, actually your staff did an excellent job in summarizing. All I'll say is that the City of Portland 10 years ago urged your passage of the enabling legislation to deal with what we call distressed areas of the city, neighborhoods that experienced large-scale poverty and had seen no housing development in decades prior to the passage of this bill. In the last 10 years, thanks to a healthy housing market and this bill and other tools for neighborhood revitalization, it's difficult to even call some of these neighborhoods distressed anymore. What we found, though, that this bill, if you choose to continue its lifespan, has proven to be an excellent and cost-effective means of helping low and moderate home buyers buy into these revitalized neighborhoods. So I'm here to really represent the City of Portland in urging you to continue the life of this bill to the year 2012 and to make it clear that purchasers of condominiums can also benefit from this. and that's it.
Questions? I have one. Marge, you've got this designation of distressed area, or is there more than one?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We handed out a map, which is attached to our testimony, which shows about four or five different areas of the city in north, northeast, and southeast Portland, which is...
So you've got these designated and approved by that 51% of the majority of the taxing districts. Question, I guess, that I have is, I'm hearing this, what's your understanding? Does it require approval? Does this extension... the provisions to condominium units become automatic within those approved areas, or does that require approval by the taxing districts as well?
Mr. Chairman, it's our intent to simply clarify that single unit housing also includes condominium units, so it would not be anticipated that we'd have to go back to the other jurisdictions and seek new approval.
But I don't see any other jurisdictions signed up in opposition to this. Any other questions? Representative Kafoury and Williams, here co-sponsors on this thing. Anything?
Good bill.
Okay. Any reason why we shouldn't go into work session on this today?
We'd appreciate it very much. Thank you.
All right. Then let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2908 and open a work session.
Chair.
Representative Kafoury.
I move House Bill 2908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kafoury moves House Bill 2908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Say.
Aye.
Staff.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Staff.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Webb.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Excused.
Kafoury.
Aye.
Chair
Shetterly. Aye. House Bill, let me get this one right, 2908, having received the majority, goes to the floor with a due pass. And Representative Kafoury, do you want to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. Very good. Now, a couple things for the balance of the meeting. Security has asked us to, am I correct, clear the room for 2 minutes. We need to go into recess for 2 minutes. It has something to do with moving the crowd in from the overflow room into here. Is that right? Okay. So we will stand in recess, not yet, but when I announce it, we'll stand in recess for 2 minutes in order to clear the room. I apologize for that, but we do what the facilities tells us to do in this building. And then we will reconvene. Apologize for all of you who are signed up to testify. I intend to get through your testimony. I'm good until 5 o'clock, as long as folks are concise. And I understand some committee members will have to leave because our time really only goes until 3. I ask your indulgence on that. We're at a time in the session where we are just doubling up our agendas because there is so much legislation yet to get through the pipeline. But we intend to receive your testimony today. And so with that said, I will recess. Pardon? Have to take your belongings. That's for your own good. Recess the meeting for until...